Welcoming to the show, multi-talented gentleman who's a singer, writer, actor, radio host. He was the lead singer of Black Flag back in the early 80s, later with the Rollins Band. You've seen him in television shows like Sons of Anarchy, several movies as well. He's getting ready to head back on the road for more stops on his Good to See You tour, which will come to Maine on September 20th at the Waldo Theater and the 21st at the Criterion in Bar Harbor. We're happy to welcome to the show Henry Rollins. Appreciate you making some time for us today.
Oh, no problem at all.
You'll be coming here to Maine and New England for shows on the Good to See You tour coming up in September. How are you finding post-pandemic travel?
Really good. I mean, I spend as much time as possible on the road doing shows. And so when the pandemic hit and one tour after another would be canceled in a single email, like 3 months of touring in one email, it just goes away. And you have to call the road manager and inform him he doesn't have a job. And the chain of sadness just keeps going out further and further as more people are called to be dismissed. And so there's a solid year there where I was told by the agent, we'll try again next year, not next month, next year, where I just thought, I have to reinvent myself at age 60. Well, you know, that's the old dog new trick thing, which might not work out so well. So when touring finally came back, I'd spent almost a year wondering if it would come back at all. So to answer your question, when I was finally turned loose back into the world in March of last year, I felt like I'd won the lottery. Yeah, because it was just so great to be back with an audience, because I understood what I had been missing immediately. I mean, I didn't have to lose it to make me miss it. I miss tours as soon as they end. And so,
do you know, when you're on stage, obviously with a band, you can sense the reaction right away. Do you know in these spoken word performances when the audience is with you, when you've got them?
Yeah. Quite often I will, you know, the show starts to even out a few shows in the actual set. You know, you have the stories. It's basically like a set for music. You go out with a bunch of songs, and I go out with a bunch of stories, and I tell them, and you start to see quickly what lands, what doesn't. Even if it's down to a single line, for some reason, something you say every single night, bam, you get a reaction. And so you can start using those as like sonar pings to see if there's anything out there. And you'll say something in from Buffalo to Seattle, and everyone says, you know, hooray or something. And then you try that in Belgium, and everyone just sits politely. You're like, okay. And it's not necessarily like it's not landing. It's just audience appreciation is different in different places. And so I keep a few people in my eye line, and I use them as monitors, because there's some people who are just reactive. Now, some people, quite often there's a couple there. The guy is a big fan of mine. The girlfriend went because the guy bought two tickets and she can't stand it. And so you'll see her just watching her phone for the entire evening. I'll watch her, because if I can get her to raise up from the phone and tune in, I must be doing something good. So rather than worry so much about how the crowd is digging it, and I do worry, I have to trust the material, and that comes from working very hard on it, not to reinvent the truth of it, but just in a great attempt to bring high quality stuff to the stage. And before COVID, I would try to earn your attention, you, the audience member, by traveling all over the world to get stories that came at great expense, you know, financial to fly to these places. And, you know, the personal expenses to go trudge through these forests and railroad tracks and souks and bazaars and villages and slums to bring back stories handpicked from countries all over the world. And so this tour I've been on is the first tour where I don't have a global perspective, where I'm not pulling a story from North Korea or Iran or Syria or Lebanon, these places I used to frequent. And so luckily, there was enough crazy things that happened stateside to me to where I can fill up a show and have it hopefully captivating.
We're talking with Henry Rollins on Town Town. Well, you have that global perspective, though, from your many years of travel. Where are we headed in America?
Right now, I think America is, as it always is to a certain degree, in transition. Because a lot of change, this is just my opinion, doesn't mean anything. But I think a lot of change in the United States isn't necessarily by law, legislation, or even a president or a movement. It's generational, where, you know, people, you know, old guys like me just drop off and a younger generation comes to the fore with just different ideas about things like war and where money should go and the role of technology or education or justice. And things in the 60s are probably not the same as they are now. And so where are we going right now? I think you're seeing the final days of a very well-moneyed and very opinionated group of people. You know, old guys like me and Dick Cheney, you know, like who really had a lot of influence. I think at some point we just stop breathing and our vacancy promotes something else. And I think that's what's happening right now, where you see some political parties, if they can't win, they just change voter registration or they gerrymander or they try to do something because legitimately they're losing their grip on power. They know it. Their demographic is shifting. They know it. And so it's like the last few seconds of an insect dying. The legs kick violently and then it's over. And I think that's where the United States is right now, where you see this kind of weird tribalism. Like, I voted for this guy, so I can't talk to you. Well, really? We're in the same supermarket. Like, why can't we get along? And I come from more of that idea of I really want to get along with everybody, and I will try rather than tribalize.
What's fueling this anger, especially from the right?
I would say what is fueling a lot of people in this country is economic uncertainty. And I really don't like pointing fingers like, oh, you're stupid. Because I'm no genius. And what person is all that stupid anyway? They're smart enough to have credit debt. I mean, like, we're all kind of stuck in this together. So I think economic uncertainty, I think diminishing of natural resources, whether you want to believe that's happening or not, is affecting you. It's hitting you at the grocery store. There's nothing like a global pandemic, we find out, to really screw up economic systems all over the world, which eventually impact the United States. So I think a lot of people who have like real world worry, like multiple kids, a mortgage, car payments, they're looking at their economic future and it doesn't necessarily look bright. And that, I think, freaks people out. It doesn't necessarily make them more generous or more concerned for their fellow person. It makes them demonize the homeless or that which is different, trans, LGBTQ, women with an opinion, non-white people. And I think that's what a lot of Americans are feeling. And I have nothing but sympathy in that I understand adult fear, because it's different than like a 16-year-old, like, will this girl go out with me? That's fluff. Compared to, I'm going upside down on the damn house and I've got two kids. That's where you don't sleep anymore. And I just think you put people in that situation, don't expect them to be all kumbaya all the time.
Is this fear of the LGBTQ plus community, is it real or is that just a way for those who have a platform to feed the base with some more anger?
I don't think it's fear at all. I think they just hate these people's guts because they just think it's invented. Like, you're a girl. You don't really want to be a boy. There's a ladies' room. Go walk in it and take care of yourself. They might not want to acknowledge the incredible complexity of Homo sapiens. Like, we are an incredibly complex species. And why run away from that? Like, oh, I'm a simple guy. And you're not that simple. You like it, the fact that you can have conflicting ideas. Like, we're a very complex creature. And now we just understand more. As far as like LGBTQ, there's been those kind of people, There's been LGBTQ folks forever. There's been people trapped in a body they're not happy in forever since human history first started. And now that you can understand that and something can be done, why would you want to keep someone from happiness? I wouldn't want to keep you from yours, and I don't care who you vote for. So I don't think it's fear. I think it's just outright hatred due to all kinds of contributing factors. You know, ignorance, or just plain, I don't like you because you're different. Or like you talk like a girl, like what's your problem? And so that comes from all kinds of things, from bad parenting to no one showed you this book. And, you know, you can fix a lot of these problems in the classroom. And maybe people shouldn't be having so many kids if you can't, if you don't want to wrestle with the idea that you're going to be raising a highly complex, paranoid, schizophrenic creature, which would be a human. Don't have five of them. How about that? I wouldn't dare have a kid. Because I understand how complex we are. I'd rather just root for them from the sidelines.
Is it tougher to be a young man now than it was when our generation was growing up?
I think there's more to know. Because I think that, you know, you're not 28 anymore, neither am I. So we're probably within 10 years at the same age. I think to a certain degree, you and I were handed quite a bill of goods. At some points, like, here's what you're a man. Here's what you need to do. Really? I don't necessarily hold with all or any of that stuff at all at this point. And so I think maybe young men now are hearing what women are saying, what girls are saying, what other men are saying. And they're realizing maybe this eat your Wheaties and show up on, you know, Friday for football practice isn't necessarily the only option. And so I think young men now may not have it as easy because they realize there's far more to be understood. Where when I was young, I was told, you're a guy, you can, you know, urinate anywhere you want because you do it standing up. And I just think I meet a lot of young people and I find the males to be far more considerate and more open-eyed than I was when I was young or when I was their age.
Now, I grew up with a single mom, and I know your dad left when you were pretty young. Was it difficult for you to figure out what manhood was about? Because you had to look other places for role models.
Absolutely. My dad was around. But neither of my parents wanted to be parents. You know, I'm an occurrence of vodka. And so they were both hard driving careerists, like super smart, really hardworking, wanting to get to the top. And suddenly they're sidelined with a kid and they got married for appearances sake. And as soon as I arrived, they divorced. And I've never seen a photo of the two of them or the three of us. I don't know if they exist. And at this point, who cares? But I remember as an old guy now, I remember looking for male role models. Even where there was a kid in my neighborhood, I would go over to their apartment and ask the kid's father to go to the park with me and throw the football. And the guy, I see it now as an older guy, because I can remember the expression on the guy's face. Like he looks at his wife, like, I'm going to go out with Henry for like 20 minutes. I'll be back. And the wife goes, oh, like the kid doesn't have a dad or a male presence. So he's coming over. And he's having like dad light, you know, like, and the guy would just like, well, Henry, here, like, throw the ball. And like, look, I got to get back to my family. And it was good seeing you, Henry. And I would do that with teachers. You know, I had a lot of male teachers at the prep school I went to. And I was just looking for a guy to tell me, like, here's how women work. Here's how to conduct yourself. Because my dad, his ideas on how to treat women are literally, to me, unrepeatable. Like the misogyny is toxic with this guy. I think he just hated and feared women. And so as far as a role model or how to conduct myself, it came in fits and starts and was probably just really bad. You know, I probably could have gone through a lot less Sturm und Drang had I had a more steady rolling male in my life going, whoa, 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 sit down, man. Like, well, we're going to talk this through because that's wrong. And luckily, I never absorbed any of my father's misogyny. But I will say, and this is probably for like a lot of young people, my early years were quite fraught with confusion. You know, I really didn't know what what end was going, go where, really.
Aging is a pretty curious thing. I just turned 65 a couple of weeks ago. I know you find great humor in this process of getting older.
I have to. Like, what choice do I have? It's either that or cry. And so I'm 62 and a half, basically. And I've grown up very publicly in that you can find photos of me for every year since like 1980. And, you know, tons, and these days with the cell phone, like photo upon photo. So people show me photos of myself all the time. Hey, dude, I met you in 1989. I see all that black hair. I'm like, oh. And so my past is thrown in my face all the time. And you see the aging process. Also, you look at people. I look at, you know, like President Obama. Like, look at all that gray hair. Like, the leader of the United States. It takes a toll on a person. And I don't necessarily compare myself, but I realize everyone goes through it. And with the pandemic, there's people I grew up with, like in Washington, D.C., who I used to see at least twice a year. And with the pandemic, you know, it took me almost 3 years to see my friend Ian MacKay. And we've been best friends for over 50 years. It's crazy. I didn't see Ian for a couple of years. And then we were finally in the same room, kind of looking at each other like these two ancient men, like, oh my God. And so for me, I think it's a process of like learning what you want and what you don't want, what you can live without, and then living without it, and not showing up for that which you don't want to show up for, and learning some patience and accepting change. Like, I can't do that anymore. Like, okay, the stairs hurt and my suitcase is heavier. And so I think I have no choice but to accept it and make fun of it.
Have you been able to shed some of the things that maybe brought you anger and frustration in the past? Or as you look around, do you see more reasons to be concerned, upset with the world?
My anger is still present, and I think it's a good thing. But what you would probably infuriate me 10 years ago, I now just chalk up to bad parenting. Like, if you showed me the previous president 20 years ago, I just would have went like, ah, I would have been so angry. Now I look at this guy and like, you weren't right for the job. You didn't ever want the job. And your parents really did a number on you. And sadly, you did a number on your kids. And I feel really bad for the kids of that guy. Because I hope they don't get the severe mental traumatizing that has seemingly been handed down generationally from, you know, the father to the son to the son to the son. And so I try to look at things with a wider scope and not be so vindictive all the time. And so I'm not mad at the homeless. I never was. I'm mad at homelessness. I'm angry at famine. I'm angry at intolerance, not the intolerant. Because like me being mad at the guy I disagree with, neither party goes anywhere. And being a grown-up, I realize I'm not going to convince you of anything, and you're not going to convince me of anything. Like if you think that global warming, global climate change is not a thing, there's nothing I can show you that will make you go, oh, wow, okay. Because you're just too old for you to relinquish intellectual territory and give me a yard to get to your goal line. We just don't do that anymore. So there's some people who just will not be swayed, like me. I think what I think, and I'm in some ways very close-minded on things, in that you're not going to turn me into a homophobe. You can't do it. And so as an older guy, I look at other people and issues with a lot more patience and a much wider lens. Like, what brought you to say that thing? And Hubert Selby, the great writer, author of Last Exit to Brooklyn, a male role model for me, actually. And he understood that, and he really embraced it. He was like a quite a cool alt dad for me. He used to say to me over and over again, maybe being instructive, that a lot of anger comes from fear. And I didn't quite understand that when he told me that as a 26-year-old. And I understand it. I started to understand that because I would see it in myself, which is perhaps why he said it to me. And so I've been able to, that's one of the things I've been able to shed. Or as the great Iggy Pop once said, you really want to make yourself an enemy of insecurity as best you can.
Well, that's great. Your public persona, you've often said your public work has been about sticking it to the man. Who is the man these days?
The man is the one who tells you that a guy can't dress like a woman and have fun in a bar and make people laugh and feel a sense of community. That's the man. And it's oppressive forces. It's not a single human being. I can't say
that would be easy.
well, it would just be like, it's because it's not like one person. It's an idea. And so the man, I just love that term. Like, why do you live? To stick it to the man. It's just too funny to resist. But the idea of the man is just those people who tell you that, oh, that person is bad. Like, really? What do you know? You've never been to that guy's neighborhood. You have no idea the 9-to-5 of that person. And so that, to me, is the man. And I'm not looking to pick up hammer and tongs or burn anyone's house to the ground. So a lot of this is just intellectual, just poking. It's not like I'm going to go burn something to the ground.
How important are your workouts, Henry, for both being able to do the shows you do, but for your mental health as well?
For me, I don't have a religion, really. I don't believe in some higher power. I believe in rock and roll. The gym is such a big deal for me. And one of the best parts of where I live is I am 4 minutes to traffic lights away from my Planet Fitness, my local Planet Fitness, which is 7 days a week, 24/7. Mm. And I go up to 2 times in 24 hours. And so maybe how someone goes to an AA meeting, sometimes they go twice a day when they're really feeling on the edge. I go to the gym up to twice a day. And, you know, I have house rules. If I'm jet lagging and I'm up bright and early at 2:30 in the morning, go to the treadmill. And I was in there last afternoon. I'll be in there in a few hours. I do 6 days a week, and I try to eat about one meal a day. And so the workout, it's not like I'm trying to put on muscle with this sagging carcass. it's more about mental toughness. And I'm almost 200 shows into this tour, and it takes a lot of intellectual oomph to get the show over the wall every night. And this time next week, I'll be almost to England. I just came back from Australia about a week and a half ago, and I'll be in England next week for a few shows. And then I've got almost 60 shows starting. That brings me to Maine later this year. And so the tour will top out at like 250 some shows. And one of the ways I get through that is, A, I love what I do, but it's good, really targeted nutrition and a very vigorous workout schedule, even on tour.
What's your ideal writing environment?
In places, not at home. A moving tour bus, an airport, an airplane, a hotel, a yurt, a tent, a coffee place on a night off. With great adverse weather happening outside the window. Anything but my desk in my office in my house, which to me, I don't mind being off the road now and then because that's where my records are. But it's, for me, life on pause. I'm not trying hard enough. So it's hard for me to get writing going when I'm off the road. So mainly when I'm off the road, I do a lot of editing. So I do the writing on the road. Mm. And the editing off the road. But even on the road, I have a full work day. I wake up in the morning, stagger to a gym, come back, get into the venue, and start my office work. I have my little road case. I set up my mini office because I'm always writing 2 books and editing one. And so it's like juggling. And so I've been working on a couple of books on this current tour. But I'd much rather be out in the world, watching the world and reacting to it, and having that inform the writing rather than being off and away from the world.
Well, and that brings up a question I wanted to ask early on, and I'm going to skip by it here. What is it about travel that opens the mind?
I think encountering other cultures, if you travel in that way, if an American goes to Holland, you're going to walk 10 paces and like bump your head into a Starbucks. It's not necessarily that different. And I'm not putting Holland down, quite the opposite. I'm just saying when a Westerner travels in the West, you might get exposed to some beautiful architecture and some maybe the politeness of Europe and the progressiveness of some European countries. But when you go to India, or when you go to the center of the African continent, or into deep Southeast Asia, or Central Asia, or the Middle East, you run into really different cultures where they just don't do things like you do necessarily. Food and drink, yes, of course. But even social, just distancing, like human polite distancing, like in India, people get inches from your face where you back away, they come with you. You're like, whoa, like, what are you doing? Like, and it's just proximity is a different thing in different places. The ideas of generosity, of this conduct on the streets, things are different. And so I sought in the 1990s to save my money and start traveling to countries where I didn't have a stage waiting for me in an effort to understand the world outside of the West. Because like touring gets me to Europe solidly all the time. Touring gets me to Australia, New Zealand, occasionally Japan, Brazil now and then, but it doesn't get me to Vietnam or to Kenya or to Egypt or North Korea, these places I've been. And so I started going to these countries and just walking around with a backpack and a camera, talking to people like, okay, man, how do you get through your day? Can I walk with you? And 80 countries later, 90 countries later, everyone said shukran and gave me a cup of tea. I've almost been killed 3 times, but that was all in the United States of America. And so as Mark Twain once said, I'm paraphrasing it best, he said, travel is like the last coffin nail in the coffin of bigotry. And I don't think I was ever a bigot. I don't think so. But as if there's any cobwebs of bigotry in my thinking, traveling on that level, just to experience another culture, just blows those cobwebs away completely. And I found myself really, this sounds really a bit much, but like kind of falling in love with Homo sapiens, because you see like this amazing cultures that are different than your own, and how people are so welcoming in places you've been told by Condoleezza Rice not to go to. And it made me, I think it probably has informed the last 20 or 30 years of my life as far as my outlook, where my outlook as an American has been informed by international travel to rainforest deserts, a lot of slums and souks and bazaars, and traveling through countries where they have Sharia law, like Saudi Arabia, where you're like, wow, this is pretty scorched earth as far as policy. Not my rock and roll, but for a week, I'll absorb, and then I'm out. I went from there to Sri Lanka, I think. I think travel has made me a better person.
How do you maintain integrity in a business that's not exactly known for it?
I don't do a lot of business. You know, I'm not shaking a lot of hands. I live in Henry World. I've written a lot of books. How did I do that? I own the publishing company. I sleep with the owner every night. I'm basically my own little camp. I don't have multiple deals with like labels and production companies. Every once in a while, I've done a TV show. So you work with a production company for 8 months and then the deal is over and you go do something else. But I wrote the script. You know, I came up with a lot of the content for what you saw. And so that's how I do that. I just don't delegate a lot to a lot of people. And I'm not looking to be in a huge cast on a TV show all the time. You know, I pick that stuff carefully, or, you know, it's not like I've got a big choice in that no one's like knocking my door down for me to be in their big Hollywood production. I'm just careful when I work with others, but for the most part, I do my own thing.
Got to ask you a quick music question. What's a great album that not enough people have listened to?
Oh, wow. Lodger by David Bowie. It's just David Bowie's one of his most interesting records. Funhouse by the Stooges, my personal favorite record. It's not taken over the world like Sgt. Pepper, but I think it should. So those are great. The third Damned album, Machine Gun Etiquette, I think is a perfect rock and roll album. There's a ton of records. Unknown Pleasures by Joy Division, I think it's as good as anything I've ever heard. And I just don't understand why Joy Division isn't more lauded, as they are already, yes. Perverted by Language by The Fall. I just think The Fall were an extraordinary band that don't get enough people, you know, yelling their bona fides from the rooftops.
I understand we had a similar inspiration in getting into radio, and it was watching Wolfman Jack and American Graffiti.
Did that get you too?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
It knocked me out. My mom had like season tickets at a movie theater like in Southwest Washington, D.C. I didn't quite understand it, but she paid the money to where you can kind of go to any movie you want from like September to April or whatever it is. And one night she said, all right, we're going to go see this film. I'm like, okay. She had good taste in movies, and what am I going to do? So I went along with her, and it was American Graffiti. And I watched that Wolfman Jack cameo, and he's such a charismatic guy anyway. He was such an amazing presenter on the radio, and the voice and the whole, you know, his stature. I saw that, and I said, okay, I wanted to learn more about this music. So my mom got me 2 50s compilation LPs, which I still have. And I hung on to that idea of this mysterious voice in the night, because I was one of those lonely kids who lived in his room, played, like, I had 4 records. And then I also had my radio, and I would listen to WPGC, which was just an FM station, and they played like what is now known as classic rock. And I'd wake up with Harv Moore in the morning, and he would tell you stories. I'd listen to Casey Kasem on Sundays, and he would tell you stories. And then later on, when I got a car, I would drive around and listen to WRC, which was talk radio. And it was political talk radio, and I didn't really understand the politics. I just liked the voices on the radio, these invisible voices who are my friends. And for hours, sometimes hours a day, I listened to a comedian named Phil Hendry, an amazing comedian, H-E-N-D-R-I-E. I think he's one of the most amazing minds going. And I've been a huge fan of Phil's, I don't know, like 15 years. And if you subscribe to his podcast, you can go back to like 20 years ago and listen to the show from then. And I'll line up like 4 of them. And as I'm editing or scanning, doing something where I don't have to pay attention, I'll just put Phil on where I don't need a visual cue. I just like the voice coming out of a speaker. And to this day, I don't have a TV. I watch things on YouTube, and I'll bootleg the news on some station on online. But I'm more of a reader and listen and stare at my speakers kind of guy. And that just comes from how I was raised. But Wolfman Jack is still in my thoughts because, you know, I am very fully engaged with a radio show. I'm in my little voiceover studio right now where I'll be toiling a few hours from now. And so wanting to be on the radio as a DJ kind of guy has been with me since I was like, whenever I saw American Graffiti, like 11 or 12, whenever I was that age.
Henry Rollins comes to Maine. 2 opportunities to see him on the Good to See You tour, September 20th at the Waldo Theater and the 21st at the Criterion Theater in Bar Harbor. Henry, it's great to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, no, thank you for the time. I appreciate it.